Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show features my conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and best-selling novelist, Anna Quinlan. We discuss Anna's literary journey, her advice for aspiring authors, and her reflections on the craft. Anna's enthusiasm and appreciation for writing are truly inspiring, and I hope that this episode will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. In the years since graduating high school, the Freedom Writers have become not only best-selling authors, but teachers themselves. Together, the Freedom Writers and I have trained nearly 800 educators from around the world. These teachers, dubbed Freedom Writer teachers, continue to spread the Freedom Writer story and message to their thousands of students and communities from across the globe. Inspired by the Freedom Writer's Diary, the first 150 Freedom Writer teachers set out on a literary journey of their own. Their book, entitled Teaching Hope, tells their stories from the classroom through one full academic school year. Just as the original Freedom Writers sought an acclaimed author to write the foreword for their book, so did the Freedom Writer teachers. Today's guest, Anna Quinlan, is an award-winning journalist, author, and columnist whose works have been published in the New York Post, the New York Times, and Newsweek. With her extensive and distinguished biography, the Freedom Writer teachers desperately wanted Anna Quinlan to write the foreword to Teaching Hope. Anna had written Write for Your Life, a heartfelt review and exploration of the Freedom Writers film in Newsweek. This gave the Freedom Writer teachers hope, and with a little luck and some good fortune, Anna agreed to write their foreword. Outside of her writing, Anna's work has been well received and rewarded. In 1992, Anna became only the third woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for commentary for her compelling columns on a wide range of personal and political topics while writing at the New York Times. A few of her books have been adapted into made-for-television movies and feature films, including One True Thing, starring Renee Zellweger and Meryl Streep, who was nominated for an Academy Award for her performance. Over the course of her career, Anna has written over 20 books, many of them becoming New York Times bestsellers, and countless articles and columns for both the New York Times and Newsweek. Thanks to her impressive resume, Anna is one of the most sought-after commencement speakers at some of the most prestigious universities in America. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Anna Quinlan. A lot of people meet via Zoom. They have backgrounds that are not theirs. And when I look at Anna Quinlan's background, which is a bookshelf, the nerdy English teacher in me, my spirit is soaring because I believe that most of those books on that shelf of hers have been written by her. She's written over 20 books. So hidden in that bookshelf are probably every copy of every book, both nonfiction and fiction, children's books and pictorials at all. So let's start there with your love of writing. Did your love of writing, Anna Quinlan, begin when you were in elementary school and were asked to read books, or when did your love of writing begin?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked the question that way, because particularly for students, I love to answer that question. I don't love writing. I really hate writing. I really hate it. Every time I sit down at the computer and pull up a document and start to work on it, there's a Jiminy Cricket on my shoulder that says, well, this is not very interesting. Well, this is not very good. Well, this is not as good as the last one. Well, this is not what the last review said you did well. It's all those voices of doubt and insecurity. And I often think that writing is as much an exercise in security and self-acceptance as it is an exercise in putting nouns and verbs together. So I think it's very important for younger people who sit at the computer and struggle and therefore conclude that they can't write to know that in my experience, there are a lot of us who do this for a living who struggle too.
I just assumed, because you've been a journalist, a columnist, and an author, that it came easy and naturally for you.
See, that's the big misconception that, and I think it's a particularly American point of view, that if you're good at something, it must mean that it's easy for you. And let's just think of this in terms of other professions. Michael Phelps, most decorated Olympian, how did he get to be so good at swimming? He did it over and over and over again, and sometimes he failed. A great surgeon becomes a great surgeon by doing it and then redoing it, thinking about it. And I think again, we do this huge disservice to young people, because when it doesn't come naturally to them, when it's not simple and easy, when a teacher says to them, this is a good start, but you need to take another crack at this, they don't hear, well, that's what writing's like. You write and then you rewrite. What they hear is, I failed. And I don't ever want any kid to feel that way, because there may be inside that kid a real writer struggling to get out. And they shouldn't mistake the struggle with lack of ability.
Where were you when I was learning to be an English teacher? And I don't say that rhetorically or facetiously. I mean that legitimately, because I think what you are able to demystify is that the struggle is real. And because I had students, as you know, the Freedom Writers, who weren't natural born writers in their minds, it was a struggle and it was awkward and uncomfortable at first. And I wish I would have had that insight when I began my journey, because it would have made it so much easier for me as well as so much easier for them.
I wish I had at hand here a copy of the first draft manuscript of one of my books, because if I did, I would just shuffle through it for you. And what you would see is my editor's annotations on virtually every page, sometimes saying nice or great or yes, all those things you want to say, and sometimes saying through an entire paragraph, which basically means this slows down the action of the book. And I'm working on a book about writing for people who aren't professional writers. And one of the things that I say is that I hate that revision process, that I hate it and fear it. And I'm a big baby about it. And I sort of stomp around the house and say, she's never understood me, even though she's edited every book I've done. And then I do it because it makes the work better. And because when it's all said and done, and I look at the finished product, it's usually very hard for me to tell what was there originally and what I fixed because Kate Medina told me to fix it.
I feel that with every book project that the Freedom Writers have worked on, that I feel, first and foremost, I have an imposter complex. And then I get very insecure. And then I want to crawl under a table in fetal position and suck my thumb. Is that image of being fetal position something that a lot of writers feel?
Yes, because think about it, particularly the kind of writing the Freedom Writers are doing is this. Hello, world. Look at me. Take me as I am, warts and all. That's the scariest thing on earth to say that. And so inevitably, there's part of you that thinks, No, let's do this. Let's do, hi world. Yeah, it's me. Except that nothing happens then. You know, in the 20th anniversary edition of the Freedom Writers Diary, you have a young man who talks about telling a very painful story about his past publicly. And he talks about how he doesn't like to tell that story. But the reason he does it is because he looks out into an audience and he sees the face of another kid who is clearly thinking, I'm not alone. And that's what makes writers write, because at that moment when someone says, you put my thoughts into words, you said what I was thinking, you made me feel less alone in the world. I mean, my God, could you do anything in your whole life more powerful than making another human being feel less alone. And that's why, despite the fact that, you know, I do hate and fear it, and every time I think I'm not very good at it, I keep on writing because of those moments of connection. And by the way, not only those moments of connection to other people, but those moments of connection to myself. I mean, sometimes I write a sentence or a paragraph and I look at it and think, oh, that's what I think. And those moments, you know, there's nothing like them.
I'm just having this out-of-body experience right now. I have to share. When I was young, I would watch my father listen to classical music. It was usually like Vivaldi or Mozart, and he would literally weep. And I could not understand. You know, my father was a professional baseball player at one point in his life, and this very macho man tearing up and weeping over something that was this wave of beauty. And when I listen to you, I feel that same feeling, like I just want to weep. And I say that to you because when I first met you, it was a moment for me of being an inappropriate fangirl. I was such a voracious reader of your work. And I think because I was so insecure, the validation that you gave us, not just by writing in Newsweek, The Last Word, but the fact that you quoted us back to the world. And I remember weeping when I read it to the Freedom Writers. I drove around town and I bought every copy of Newsweek that I could find. I have 150 students, so I had to find 150 copies of Newsweek at the time. And we actually included what you wrote in our teacher's guide because I wanted the teachers that came after us to read what you wrote. I want to know if I could share some of the things that you wrote then that make me weep, like my father listening to Vivaldi. You titled it Write for Your Life. And you said, Freedom Writers is about the power of writing in the lives of ordinary people. That's a lesson everyone needs. So kind of at the gate, you demystify that it's just for people in the ivory tower or those fancy publications. But here's where it really got to me. And then one day, she, being this crazy teacher here, she gives them all marbled composition books and the assignment to write their lives, ungraded, unjudged, and the world breaks open. So beautiful. You go on to say, writing can make pain tolerable, confusion clear, and the self stronger. Words on paper confer a kind of immortality to make sense of themselves. Anna, to have someone of your caliber, a Pulitzer Prize winning author, say those things about my students, about this process and this journey. I feel like my father wanting to weep because your words to me are Vivaldi. They're so beautiful and poetic. And I get it now. I didn't get it when I was a kid, but I get it now when something just moves your spirit. And your words, even if it's not easy, are so poetic and so profound and yet so full of empathy. So where does that poetry come from?
Oh, well, first of all, thanks, Erin. You know, I don't really know. Unlike your students who had learned to think poorly of themselves, who had learned to think that they were unteachable, as someone told you, who were told that they were stupid, that they had no future, I was lucky enough to be raised in a household in which there was an expectation that I was going to be and do something. To go back to your question, I had a certain facility with words from the time I was quite young. But the important thing from your point of view to know about that is that facility with words was rewarded over and over again by teachers. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I always say is, I am a writer because of teachers. Except for my parents, teachers were the most important people in my life. My eighth grade nun, Mother Mary Ephraim, who was really smart and really tough, looked over her glasses one day at me as she was handing me back a paper and said, you are a writer. Now, who was I to argue with Mother Mary Ephraim? And one of the things that I think is so important is to emphasize that, because there's not enough discursive writing going on in schools. There's too much writing to the test. That's not really writing. That's kind of stenography. And what you want is for students to do, pour their heart out writing and to be validated, maybe not validated as writers, but validated as feelers. And I was validated from a very, very young age. And I think that that helped me embrace a kind of facility with words that stayed with me. My elder son and I talk all the time about books that we both love, and we have quite different tastes. And one of the things that we've talked about is that I think there are cool writers and there are warm writers. And cool writers are often very talented and hyper-intellectual, and warm writers are different. And I'm a warm writer. I do feel that connection to the reader. I do feel when I'm writing as though there's someone there, you know, because if I didn't, I wouldn't keep on doing it. And I think that that feeling of connection is something that I try to have come through in the work.
And I think in 2021, we all missed empathy and compassion with that bully at a bully pulpit for so long, that your former profession as both a journalist and a columnist was the emotional pinata of our former president. And I think what you did every single day, whether it was starting at the New York Post and then eventually going to the New York Times and then to Newsweek, every day you showed up and you shared stories and you were anything but the enemy of the people. But how did that feel to have someone with power create a dialogue with others that journalists were not to be trusted? They were to be feared, that there was something called fake news. How did that feel knowing that you spent your entire career doing something that was so noble?
Well, it felt pretty terrible, but I couldn't believe that the American people over the long haul were going to buy it. Americans are people who like to complain about things that they can't possibly give up. So there was all of the fake news from people who were glued to the news. They might not have been glued to the kind of news that I consume, but on the other hand, I had a greater ability to consume news than at any time in American history, because I could get the BBC on my computer, I could read the Chicago Tribune, the LA Times, as well as the New York Times and the Washington Post. So the extent to which there is so much information out there, I find pretty heartening and thrilling. And I almost feel as though since January, the idea of fake news has begun to dissipate, that it was kind of a manifestation of the cult, and the cult leader has lost power and gone to Palm Beach, and suddenly we're trafficking in facts and data again.
So I want to go back to you being a high school student, and I love that you chose the Sister College of Columbia Barnard. Did you know as a high school student that you were going to be a writer professionally when you went off to college? Was that what you pursued initially because your nuns and teachers said you were a great writer, or did you have an epiphany in that beautiful ivory tower?
Underneath my high school yearbook, it says that my goal is to write the great American novel. It's so arrogant that it makes my eyes cross. And in fact, my college essay, which they resurfaced at some point because I was chair of the board at Barnard where I graduated, says something similar in very rounded handwriting that I don't really have anymore. Yeah, so that's really what I wanted. I didn't really have any ambitions to go into the newspaper business. I really wanted to be a novelist. I was an English major, but with a concentration in creative writing at Barnard, which has produced more great female writers than almost any place on earth. I mean, Jhumpa Lahiri graduated from Barnard, Edwidge Dantegott, Catherine Boo, Natalie Angier, Erica Jong. The list just goes on and on and on. And I went there in part because I felt that I wasn't taken as seriously in high school as my male counterparts because I was female. And Barnard was then and remains a place that takes being a woman very seriously. But while I was there, I realized that I couldn't quite figure out how I could be a novelist and make a living. And I really wanted to make a living. I'd been the editor of my high school newspaper. I decided to try to get a newspaper job. And first, I was a copy girl at my local daily in New Jersey. And then I went to the Post as a summer intern and stayed there after college. And then I went to the Times.
I've watched some of your previous interviews, and I love how you said that your first beat was probably one of the most difficult jobs, but you learned the most because you were kind of thrown into all these experiences. You were supposed to have the ear of the young folk, but it was the early 70s. And so everything that was happening culturally at that time was that youth movement. So what was that like to be on the beat as a college student covering these incredible movements, whether it was the Vietnam War or voter rights or civil rights?
I didn't realize at the time how lucky I was. First of all, that my editors would trust this 19-year-old girl who really was green to go out and cover a story, but they did. And second of all, that this was this kind of, well, we didn't really realize what a cauldron of change the early 70s was. I mean, it's only in retrospect that it's as clear as it is now. So the anti-war movement, the women's movement, I just got to do an incredible array of stories when I was too young to really appreciate how important they were, and too young to do a really first-class job, to which I have to add that I had the most spectacular editors at both the New Brunswick Home News and then at the Post, who really never said to me, "Kid, what the heck are you doing here? You don't know what you're doing." Who just really helped me grow into the job in a way that, you know, I just can't thank people enough for.
You know what I love that you were able to do at that time. At 19, I understand that you went home from your sisterhood at Barnard to help take care of your mother, who sadly passed away from ovarian cancer. But that must have done something to your psyche that makes you grow up faster than most. And that ultimately became the work of one true thing that also became a semi-fictional feature film starring Meryl Streep as your mother. So what was that like to go back and recount that really painful moment and decide that this is going to become part of a semi-fictional work that would become both a best-selling book and then a heavily touted film where Meryl Streep was nominated for an Academy Award?
Yeah, but Meryl getting nominated for an Oscar, I mean, you know, I feel like I could have written The Cat in the Hat and Meryl would have got nominated for an Oscar. I think there's two distinct parts of this, Erin. The first is that nursing my mother through the end stage of ovarian cancer and then working as a city desk clerk at the New Brunswick Home News while taking care of my three younger brothers and my sister before I went back to school completely changed my life in every way. I am the person I am in large part because first I was Prudence Quinlan's daughter and then I was her survivor. And that just changes everything, being a motherless daughter. But I didn't really think of one true thing in that way. I think in every novel you find something that is not necessarily literally true of your life, but is kind of a touchstone of your life. For example, I have a novel called Still Life with Breadcrumbs, in which the main character is a photographer who has been famous for a certain kind of domestic photography. And I'm not a photographer, but I understand what it's like to have people think of you in a certain kind of way because of the art that you produce, which is considered stereotypically female. So with One True Thing, the touchstone was that I understand what it looks like when someone's dying by inches of cancer. But Kate Golden, the mother, and Ellen Golden, the daughter, are so different in so many ways from my mother and I that it sort of changes the whole thing. I think the exciting and miraculous moment was I created, I want to say a two-dimensional picture, but that's not really true because one hopes in the reader's mind that it's all become very three-dimensional, but certainly on the page, there it is, you know. And then to have them bring it to life, to walk into a house that was decorated just as I described and have Meryl embody Kate in a way that was just as I imagined her. It's incredibly exciting when that happens, particularly when it's done by really good people with really clear intentions. And that was my good luck.
Do you think Renee Zellweger, who played the daughter, had elements of you as that young woman?
I think to the extent that she was kind of hard and ambitious at the beginning and eventually came to understand the value of the kind of life her mother had lived and the kind of person her mother was, I certainly think that she embodied some of the qualities that I had when I was much younger, before, frankly, I grew up.
You know, when you look at your breadth of work and over 20 books, nonfiction to fiction to children's art to actually pictorials, it's fun to kind of guess when you are the reader how much of Anna Quinlan is in all these stories. If they are fictionalized, how much is real? If they're nonfiction, how much of that is you telling your truth? I was so excited with your story, Good Dog Stay, because I have a Labrador whose name is Bo, and your Labrador, his name was Bo. And I'd love to have a little taste of what it was like to write a book about your beloved dog.
You know, I wrote a column first for Newsweek, and writing the dog column is kind of the cliche of columnizing. If you're going to do it, you've really got to do a good job because so many people have tried to do it before. And my editor sort of circled around to me and said, look, you know, I really think this cries out to be a book. And I thought, oh no, not the dog book. But you know, it's one of those things where people connect so viscerally to you that when you do it, you're glad that you did it. And that's how I feel about it. I mean, since Bo, there was B, who is on the back cover of Good Dog Stay. And now B is no longer with us. And now there's Gus. And Gus's younger number is named Ella. And Ella might be my last Labrador because she's 3. And by the time she's an old dog, which is really hard to imagine because she's a young Labrador, which is nothing like an old dog, I'll be 80. And I'm not sure I'm up for a new Labrador at 80, but I guess I'll wait and see how I feel then.
You know, what I loved about Black and Blue, this was nothing about your personal life. Another best-selling book that became an award-winning film on television. And how do you create characters where they're so different from you? You have this beautiful, loving husband that you met in college and these 3 great kids. And then you write this story about extreme domestic violence and escape. And that horrific story playing out also through the eyes of a young child. So how did you think of something like that that is not your personal touchstone?
Well, first of all, critics and reviewers have believed that every single protagonist in each of my novels is me. Even though they're very different from each other, there's always that way that they find the connection. And there always is a connection because writing fiction is a little like making sausage. Everything I am, everyone I know, everything I've seen gets ground up and comes out in the last analysis. So in Black and Blue, I did not seek to write a novel about domestic violence. I didn't know anything about domestic violence. I've never researched domestic violence. I was thinking about the fact that women become clothed in the people that they love and care for. So if you ask a woman about herself, she identifies as somebody's mother, somebody's wife, somebody's friend, somebody's daughter. And if a woman lost all of that, what would it take for her to recreate herself? If she'd lost all of those beloved layers. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought that none of the women I know in real life would intentionally give up any of that. You know, there's this great tradition of the picaresque novel. You wake up one day, you pack a small bag and you hit the road, you know? women don't do that. It took too long to like find the right coffee mug and you know, hang those shades in the bedroom and everything. They cling to their nest. So eventually I realized that if I wanted to explore that question of identity, of stripped down identity, it would have to be a woman who had to leave her life. And that's what brought me to the idea of Fran Flynn and Bobby Benedetto and her using almost an underground railroad to help women who were being beaten by their husbands to flee from them. And one of the most heartbreaking questions I ever got about that book were when women at book signings would sidle up to me and say, "Can you tell me more about the Underground Railroad?" And I would realize that what they thought was that it was a real thing and that I could tell them how to be in touch with it so that they could get out of the situation that they were in. For all I know, such a thing does exist. I have no knowledge of that. I completely invented the one in the book.
I think you probably experienced, as the Freedomers have, whenever we've done book signings after a presentation, it's always the last two or three people who have that connection, and it's heart-wrenching. It's also very heroic, but they linger because in that moment, it's not just about a signature in a book. It's, I too have a story. So having done over 20 books, I can imagine those last folks in line for every one of your books, there's that storyteller. And what do you usually tell that storyteller? Do you encourage them to pick up a pen? Do you encourage them to write what needs to be written?
It depends on why they've approached me. I've had to say over and over again to the people who run bookstores, who are, by the way, all fantastic people, you know, who are interested in making the event work correctly. And I have to say to them, there are going to be people who stop in this line and give me things or tell me things, and they cannot be hurried. And I understand that you want to move the line along and everything. But if somebody is standing in front of me weeping, we cannot hurry her. And sometimes they just want to respond. You know, they've read the book, they've had a profound reaction to it, and they want to communicate that profound reaction to the person who wrote the book. And sometimes they do have a story that they want to tell me, but mostly I just listen because mostly they just want me to be present. It's incredibly humbling. I can't remember where I was at an event, and a man and a woman came to the table, and the man said, "We just drove 3 hours to be here because this is the thing on her bucket list." And I just thought, how can I be the thing on the bucket list? But if I am going to be the thing on the bucket list, boy, I'd better be the best thing on the bucket list that anybody could imagine sitting behind an author's table.
And I love your humility about that, because when I met you, you were on my bucket list. And I remember meeting you at a screening in New York for our film. And with me was my student, Maria, who is the basis of Ava in the film. And we sat a couple rows in front of you. And I saw for the entire 2 hours, not because of the film, but the fact that Anna Quinlan was in the theater. It was overwhelming to me. As a student of writing and a teacher of writing, it doesn't get any better for someone like me to be in your presence.
Isn't the opposite just the worst? I mean, you know, when you do a bookstore signing, they will say to you all the time, very tentatively, "Will you personalize?" And I say, "Yeah." And they say, "And can someone take a picture?" And I go, "Yeah." And I think, what kind of person writes a book and puts it out there, which is like, you know, I write this and I go, okay, I'm giving you this piece of myself, and then says, "Well, you can have a piece of myself, but I won't let you take my picture." I don't get that. I mean, I feel like the relationship between writers and readers is very important to both of them. And the writer particularly ought to bring her A game to that.
You know, you always heard the adage about nurture versus nature, but having three kids who all of them dabble or make their livelihood in writing and publishing. How does it feel that they have followed in your footsteps? I know they do many creative things. I mean, your daughter acted and was a comedian, but also proudly states that she's a writer, and your sons as well. So how does that feel that all three of your kids have embraced that?
Oh, I think it was Matthew Rich, Frank Rich's son. I think I just saw an interview with that totally captured why I think my kids are comfortable with writing. And it's because, I don't want to be flippant about this, but to a certain extent, I made it look doable. So, okay, she gets a cup of coffee every morning and she vanishes upstairs. And 2 hours later, she comes down and says, "Oh my God, oh, it's so terrible." And she gets more coffee and goes back upstairs. And I think I demystified it in a way that I think lots of parents can demystify certain professions for kids. I mean, look, it's no coincidence that a lot of police officers in this country are second, third, fourth generation police officers because they've sat at the dinner table and listened to the stories about how it works to work on the street, or doctors or lawyers. And I think the same is true with writers. I don't think that there's any question of, you know, some weird little allele on one of my genes that got passed down to these three that suddenly made them able to string words together. But I think from a very early age, they thought putting words down on the page is something that you can do for a living. And I think there probably was a moment, given what a wacky mom I was with my hair on fire, when they thought, if this woman can do it, anyone can do it.
Take me to 1992, when you are the third woman to win the Pulitzer Prize. And I want to read how they claimed you. They said it was for her compelling columns on a wide range of personal and political topics. So you're at the New York Times. It's 1992. Did you know that they threw your hat in the ring? Had they thrown your hat in the ring in other years? And what is that like to get the most coveted award for a writer?
I had a kind of a tip off because the head of the Pulitzer board at that point was a man named Michael Gartner, who was also the president of NBC News. And I worked almost entirely at home because of the kids. But it just so happened that I was in my office at the Times that day, and the Today Show called up and asked me if the next morning I would go on in the first hour. And I'd been on the Today Show a number of times, but I'd never been on in the first hour, which is a much newsier hour. And given the fact that at 3 o'clock that afternoon, the Pulitzers were going to be announced, the fact that they wanted me on the next morning and that Michael Gartner might be in the know sort of made me go, And it's just thrilling. But some people parlay the Pulitzer into a better job. I already had the best job in journalism, so that wasn't the issue. Here's what I still think of as the best thing about Pulitzer. So at 3 o'clock, telephone rings. This is how long ago this was. This is Western Union calling from Miss Anna Quinlan. This woman says, "The president of Columbia University is pleased to inform you that you have won the..." Oh my goodness, this is wonderful. I said, "Thank you very much. Could you finish reading?" So she finishes and then she says, "We'll send you a copy of the telegram." And I get off the phone and I call my father's house. And his wife answers the phone. And I said, "Can I talk to my dad?" And she said, "He's out driving around in the truck because every 20 minutes, news radio says that you won the Pulitzer." And that was the high point of winning the Pulitzer for me, that my dad was driving around in the truck listening to that. Oh. And next morning when I went on the Today Show, he went with me. For my father to be able to swan around saying that for the rest of his life, that was infinitely more important to me.
Family means the world to you. And I love that when my forever family, my Freedom Writer teacher family, wanted to choose a foreword written by the most significant writer, that you were unanimously chosen. And I remember being so nervous reaching out to you to ask if you would do us the honor of writing the foreword. And because you have a sister who is in our chosen profession, you graced us with that opportunity. I want to read the paragraph that always makes me cry, because I kid you not, Anna, you just make me cry. As I said earlier, my Vivaldi. It's the last paragraph of the foreword. And what you do throughout the foreword is pay such homage to such a difficult profession. And in Teaching Hope, it was 150 teachers from every state in America and several provinces of Canada. But based on our foreword, you had read every single word, you had validated them, you evoked them in your foreword. But I want to read this because I want our listeners who may not be familiar with your work to become familiar with your work. You said, and so I stick with my blanket statement. Earlier, you had talked about teachers having the most difficult job. It's the toughest job there is, and maybe the most satisfying too. There are lives lost in this book, and there are lives saved too. If salvation means a young man or woman begins to feel deserving of a place on the planet. Quote, everyone knows I'm gonna fail, says one boy, and then he doesn't. What could be more soul satisfying? These are the most influential professionals most of us will ever meet. The effects of their work will last forever. Each one here has a story to tell, each different. But if there is one sentiment, one sentence, that appears over and over again, it is this simple declaration, I am a teacher. They say it with dedication and pride, and well they should. On behalf of all students, current, former, and those to come, let me echo with a sentiment of my own. Thank you for what you do. And so I weep every time I read that aloud, because you honor a profession that is so hard, where my brethren and your sister are overworked and underpaid. And to have that validation from someone who gets us and gets it and has a Pulitzer Prize behind it was the greatest moment for me, opening up that book and reading that aloud. And I thank you for that.
Well, I will go out on a limb and say that even though it doesn't get reflected enough in public or even in private, I would imagine that almost every person in America has a story like that, of a teacher who brought them along.
You know, there's a question I want to ask you that I was so thankful that in your Newsweek column that you covered it. I had reached out to you after one of our Freedom Rider teachers featured in this book lost her job because she had bought the Freedom Rider's diary and passed it out in Meridian, Indiana. And you wrote a story about that in your column. And it really hearkened to what is a banned book and what is censorship. So as a prolific writer, I want to pose that question to you. What is a banned book and what is censorship to you?
I don't think there should be such a thing as a banned book. And I know that we're hypersensitive now about content that people find destabilizing. We have trigger warnings that we didn't have at the time that I was writing that column, for example. But I think that we underestimate what reading can do for people when we suggest that facing your worst fears in the pages of a book will, by definition, be unacceptable. I think over and over again, people have faced their worst fears in the pages of a book and found them neutered in a way that made them less fearful, less challenging. Again and again, and during Banned Books Week, young people are sold short. You know, will young people who read about witchcraft in The Crucible or in Harry Potter become Satanists? Will young people who read about sexual situations become sexually active? We so talk down to younger people, as though we were never young ourselves, or as though we think the worst of the young people we once were. I think everybody should be able to read everything and decide for themselves whether it's good or bad, whether it has meaning for their life, or whether it has meaning that leads them in a different direction. I think untrammeled reading is the best thing we can do.
The Freedom Writers are starting a new book project, and they've passed the baton to 50 young student authors. And it's going to be a cry for help, a letter written by the youth. And the Freedom Writers and the Freedom Art teachers are going to help them with a solution. Hopefully they're on the other side of that scenario. So for those 50 young authors who have had trauma, who are writing their narrative and shining the spotlight on their truth, what would your advice for them be? They're eager and excited and also nervous. So what would you encourage them to do as this process begins?
You know, the most sort of flippant response I always get when people ask about writing is put your butt in a chair. People spend a lot of time thinking about writing and talking about writing. And no, writing gets done by putting your butt in a chair and putting words on the page. But I would also tell them that they're going to have to make their peace with going deep. There's a Robert Frost quote, "No tears in the writer, no tears in the reader." Ooh. And it applies to a lot of things. So no honesty or empathy in the writer, no honest, empathetic response in the reader. If you want them not only to feel your truth, but to connect it to their own, you have to go deep. I would refer back, as I did at the beginning, to that young freedom writer who said, "I don't necessarily want to tell this story or read it over and over again, but I do it to make that connection." And it's that connection that they're going to have to go for. You sit with the copybook, or you sit with the laptop or the phone, and you think, there's somebody right there and they're waiting for me to validate their life.
You wrote it so beautifully in your book, how reading it changed my life. So for these young authors, if they have discovered you and they were to pick up a book to read, to become better writers, of all of your books, then there's so many, is there one or two that you would recommend for these young authors to read in your incredible bookshelf that can help them be better writers?
Well, so much depends on what kind of people they are to begin with. As we all know, there are certain people who are intuitively drawn to novels, to stories. And there are others who like that idea of nonfiction that's grounded in the world. But the book that younger people seem to respond to very viscerally is the shortest book I've ever written. It's called A Short Guide to a Happy Life.
That was based on your speech. Is that correct?
It was based on a commencement speech I gave. And over again, high school students and college students have told me that they felt guided by it in a way that is really moving for me.
So for students who love nonfiction, we'll recommend that. But for students who love fiction, what would you recommend?
I think the book that I've written that shows the deepest understanding of younger people is a very difficult novel to read at some level. It's called Every Last One. And I would say four of the central characters in it are teenagers, but it's a book that understands what it's like to be young and how hard it can be.
So for every book club around the globe for our audience, there's a book that you are working on now. And when can we read it? And what can we anticipate from this next book project that is imminent?
Well, I'm working on a book about writing, but writing for, as I say, civilians. A clarion call for all of us to write, as opposed to losing our words, our thoughts, our observation in a reign of computer code, which is what we're doing right now. I'm working on the revisions right now, so I don't know how soon there'll actually be a book, but I would imagine it'll be sometime in the next 12 months or so.
My last question for you is, as an author and an activist and just a general advocate of the written word, I love that you still believe in pen and paper, writing letters to folks over than just an email or the telephone. So could you talk about why not losing that art form is so important for you, that we don't lose that connection to a pen, to a piece of paper, and just the art of writing?
Because those are actual physical things. I think of my children coming up to this desk where I work the day after I've died. Conceivably, they could sift through endless documents on my computer, you know, to see if there are essays or half-finished pieces or communications that they want to hold fast and treasure. Or they could do something much more simple, elegant, and timeless. They could open this drawer, and there could be a letter sitting here. And it, you know, we tend to think that when a new form comes along, it needs to edge out the old one. I mean, when paperback books first came out, there were all kinds of pieces about how hardcovers were over. Why would anybody pay $25 for a hardcover when you could get a paperback for $14? But we now know that some people like hardcover books and some people like paperback books and some people like digital books. And I don't think that the instant communication that we have with texts and emails and Instagram posts should edge out the personal letter, which not only is timeless, but also is personal in a different way. I mean, if you read my emails, they're set in the font that I've set my emails in, Times New Roman. If you look at my letter, it's written in my handwriting. So that when you look at my letter, to a certain extent, what it says is, Anna was here. And I think there's a value to that, particularly for the people that we love and may leave behind, that electronic communication just can't match.
I'm so grateful to our guest, Anna Quinlan, for sharing with us her insight and experience. In her honor, may each of us demystify the struggles of writing to encourage new authors to find their voice. May we validate young writers for their feelings and for their words. And may we all empower each other to face our fears, tell our truths, and share our stories. If you'd like to see my full interview with Anna Quinlan, it will air on May 1st, 2021 on the Freedom Writers Foundation website, our YouTube channel, or our Freedom Writer Foundation Facebook account. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Martin Hall and Rob Falk. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.